US. On the deck of the ship, there are also containers full of ammunition and explosives in plain sight. It is extremely dangerous and against international and Italian laws.
About 10 days ago, Kalp dockers, together with rights associations and pacifist movements, staged a protest demanding the port authority more transparency on ships' cargoes transiting in Genoa. Dockers have said the demands have not yet been addressed.
These ships carrying cargo of arms and explosives are not just operating in breach of international and Italian laws. Cargo of this sort is extremely dangerous for the dockers and for thousands of people living in the surroundings of the port of Genoa. In addition to that, ships are moored near a chemical warehouse and an oil depot. You can imagine the safety implications of that.
The Weapon Watch Observatory has also found that the number of Italian aircraft carriers that are transporting weapons towards Poland has dramatically increased over the past weeks. Rome has been sending tons of arms and humanitarian aid to Ukraine since the start of the conflict there. The arms industry in Italy is prospering. 10 years ago, Rome was the 10th largest weapons producer in the world. Today it stands as the 6th. Furthermore, following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, the Mario Draghi government has honored a pledge made to NATO a few years ago, rising military spending from 1.4 to 2% of GDP by 2028. Max Civili, Rome.
Millions of EU citizens are really starting to feel the pinch. Inflation in the 19-country eurozone is currently at 7.5%. The European Central Bank, ECB, wants inflation to be at just below 2%. It means the cost of living is out of control.
The impact of the war on the economy will depend on how the conflict evolves, on the effect of current sanctions, and on possible further measures.
On Thursday, the ECB said energy prices have increased by 45% in the past 12 months. Business and consumer confidence has fallen through the floor due to the conflict in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia. There are major supply issues. The cost of living is rising, but wages are not, according to the ECB. We have been speaking to EU citizens.
We have also a lot of refugees in Poland, so it's also a huge problem now for our country, for the healthcare system and every other area.
We have to take the car, we're trying to take everybody at the same place and try to share with other peoples, and of course everything in the food also. I mean, it's a big problem. Yeah,
when I drive with a car or something, and yeah, the prices went so high, as a student I cannot pay it.
If the Ukrainian conflict continue, there will be problem, because Russian and Ukraine are two of the most important food producers, so there will be problem about food price.
And as a business person, are you worried about losing your business?
Yeah, it's stopping if you don't have the parts to construct your thing.
The next update from the European Central Bank is scheduled to take place on the 9th of June. So how badly could things possibly deteriorate for EU citizens between now and then? To quote the head of the bank, Christine Lagarde, who knows? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Memorial service is held to pay tribute to a major figure in the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, late Lieutenant General Mohammad Hejazi. Hejazi was the deputy commander of the IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. The top general died last year after years of battling the effects of exposure to chemical agents in Iraqi gas attacks during the 1980s Iran-Iraq War.
General Hejazi was on the front line of the fight against the occupying Israeli regime. He was highly skilled in scouting for and training members of the resistance. The likes of General Hejazi and General Soleimani trained many resistance members who have turned into flag bearers of the resistance axis.
Hejazi's name goes hand in hand with Major General Qasem Soleimani, an anti-terror military commander who was assassinated in a U.S. air raid in Iraq in January 2020. IRGC officials say Hejazi stood shoulder to shoulder with General Soleimani in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria.
When it comes to the fight against Daesh terrorists, General Hejazi played a key role in training the resistance fighters, both physically and ideologically, to readily fight the terror group. He led several operations that dealt heavy blows to the terrorists.
General Hejazi joined the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps during the early days of its establishment in 1979. He was a veteran of the eight-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, before being appointed as the head of the Basij, a paramilitary force affiliated to the IRGC. Hejazi also served as an intelligence and security advisor to Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. He became the deputy commander of the Quds Force in late January 2020, after the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani. He was on the list of the U.S. and Europe sanctions as part of bans imposed on the IRGC. From serving in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s to fighting terrorism in the region, General Hejazi grew to become a vital piece in the IRGC's activities, so that the military force still mourns his death as a huge loss. That's, quote, irreplaceable. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A hearing to review the case of a Palestinian prisoner has been held at an Israeli court. After the hearing, the court said Ahmad Manasra's case doesn't apply under terrorism laws. This means his lawyers can appeal for his release. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
Ahmad Manasra, this Palestinian youth who was arrested 6 years ago when he was only 13 years old, is suffering mental health issues due to torture and solitary confinement he faces in Israeli jail. Ahmad's lawyers had appealed to the Israeli court against a special prison committee's rejection of a request to have Ahmad's case reviewed by a parole committee after he had served two-thirds of his sentence. The Israeli court of Bir al-Sabah held a hearing to review Ahmad's case. They only decided that his case doesn't come under the terrorism law.
Ahmad Manasra is an example of the persecution of children in Palestine. He's a child who was arrested while he was 13 years old only. He was persecuted, he was oppressed, he was tortured, and he was frightened, and he has become a victim of physical and psychological abuse from the Israeli side. That's why there is a huge campaign now demanding his release.
After years of his detention, no one can forget the video of an Israeli interrogator violently questioning a Palestinian child. In the video, Israeli interrogator kept screaming at Ahmad and accusing him of lying. Ahmad repeatedly told the interrogator that he couldn't remember. Ahmad was referring to the day when Israeli settlers opened fire at him and left him bleeding on the ground after being run over by an Israeli settler's car. Israeli settlers cursed him, damning him to death. This came after his 15-year-old cousin Hassan was shot dead by Israeli settlers. They accused both Ahmad and Hassan of attempting to carry out a knife-stabbing attack.
The Israeli committee originally rejected looking into Ahmad Mansara's file on the basis that its case falls under the terrorism law. Now, after the latest ruling, Ahmad's lawyers want to request to have his case reviewed by a parole committee. He has served 6 of his 9-year sentence and is suffering from mental health issues.
A global solidarity campaign has pressured the Israeli courts to hold a hearing to review and possibly appeal Ahmad's case. The Israeli court has only decided to cancel the previous decision that Ahmad Manasra's case comes under the so-called terrorism law. However, Ahmad's family and lawyers hope that the next session will be soon, as there is a serious need to release Ahmad immediately due to his severely deteriorated mental condition. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak are fighting for their political lives. This after it emerged both men were amongst dozens to receive fines from the Met for their part in Partygate, the series of gatherings that took place during the height of COVID restrictions in and around the corridors of British power. Labour leader Keir Starmer led the chorus of voices urging them to go.
But the guilty men are the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. They've dishonoured all of that sacrifice. They've dishonoured their office. This is the first time in the history of our country that a Prime Minister has been found to be in breach of the law. And then he lied repeatedly to the public about it. Britain deserves better. They have to go.
The Chancellor has issued a statement giving his unreserved apologies over the matter. The Prime Minister, however, attempted an explanation of sorts.
There was a brief gathering in the Cabinet Room shortly after 2 p.m., lasting for less than 10 minutes, during which people I work with kindly passed on their good wishes. And I have to say, in all frankness, at that time, it did not occur to me that this might have been a breach of the rules. But of course, the police have found otherwise, and I fully respect the outcome of their investigation.
Johnson's critics feel the Prime Minister not only failed the British people with his leadership during the peak of COVID, but continued to do so with these fresh revelations.
I'm stunned. In all British history, no Prime Minister has ever been fined by the police before. And this is a law he introduced, that we all spent 2 years basically in self-isolation. And he's just having not just one party, but about a dozen of these parties. And for somebody who makes the law, who is our Prime Minister, to then break it so many times, he shouldn't just be resigning from office. He should be going to prison.
The support being shown to the Prime Minister and the Chancellor will be of cold comfort to those who lost loved ones during COVID. And the apologies of both men will ring hollow to those who managed to make the ultimate sacrifice and who are now wondering why those who made the rules seemed incapable of following them. Amina Taylor, London. Uncertain times for millions of Brits. A sharp spike in the cost of living combined with stagnant pay rates mean many are counting the pennies and being forced into making stark choices.
I've got a broken back right now with metal screw and bone in my back. And the pain with the arthritis I've got is horrible. And the cost of living, of electric and gas and petrol and food, is horrible. You know what I have to do? Go from shop to buy cut price things which is on sale.
There's going to be people out there that are too afraid to switch on a kettle for some hot water. You know, that kettle is going to cost me 46p to boil. No. No one should be living like this. This isn't the Stone Age. I'm not going down a mine this afternoon. This is 2022.
The signs for British householders have been ominous. Interest rates hitting a record high of 6.2% earlier this year, supply issues associated with Brexit, the global impact of COVID, a spike in energy costs, the crisis in Ukraine, and a hike in national insurance contributions have all contributed. Food bank use amongst working people has hit record highs, with ever more falling into debt, according to published figures. There's a growing sense of frustration and desire to cast blame.
What the government is doing, the government has to look into this matter. They should think that what the common people will do, what they will do, they cannot survive in this country.
I'm appalled that we are left in this situation. We've just came through 2 years of COVID. And now, by the way, people, here you go, energy cap. It feels like the government is like, oh, well, you just came through hell. Here's a little bit more.
The terrifying reality is that for millions of Brits, this is simply the beginning. Flash forward a few months when temperatures would have plummeted and savings, if any, depleted. We'll start to see a real rise in half-empty fridges and bare cupboards and a growing sense of desperation, despair and anger. Boris Johnson's government says it's doing more than any other administration to lift Brits out of poverty. On recent evidence, there will be millions who wholeheartedly disagree. Amina Taylor, London.
As a neighbouring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition, but we won't let anyone to ruin our solidarity.
Afghans also echo Iran's voice against enemies' plots and Cold War. Experts say neither the knife attacker in Mashhad represents Afghans, nor allegations of Iran mistreating Afghan refugees are true. They believe enemies of the two nations are using the media to sow discord.
The Mashhad incident that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight.
At the core of the theory of a possible criminal case against former President Donald J. Trump is the argument that he knew he had lost the election and sought to overturn it anyway. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled Panel suggests Trump knew he'd lost the election, eyeing criminal case. Shortly after the 2020 presidential election, as ballots were still being counted, the top data expert in President Donald J. Trump's re-election campaign told him bluntly that he was going to lose. In the weeks that followed, as Donald Trump continued to insist that he had won, a senior Justice Department official told him repeatedly that his claims of widespread voting fraud were meritless, ultimately warning him that they would hurt the country. Those concerns were echoed by the top White House lawyer, who told the president that he would be entering into a murder-suicide pact if he continued to pursue extreme plans to try to invalidate the results of the 2020 presidential election. Yet, Mr. Trump, time and again, discounted the facts, the data, and many of his own advisers as he continued to promote the lie of a stolen election. According to hundreds of pages of exhibits, interview transcripts and email correspondence assembled by the House committee investigating the 6th of January attack for a legal filing released late on Wednesday, 9th of March. In laying out the account, the panel revealed the basis of what its investigators believe could be a criminal case against Donald Trump. At its core is the argument that, in repeatedly rejecting the truth that he had lost the 2020 election, including the assertions of his own campaign aides, White House lawyers, two successive attorneys general, and federal investigators, Donald Trump was not just being stubborn or ignorant about his defeat, he was knowingly perpetrating a fraud on the United States. It is a bold claim that could be difficult to back up in a court of law, but in making it, the House committee has compiled an elaborate narrative of Mr. Trump's extraordinary efforts to cling on to power. In it, Donald Trump emerges as a man unable or unwilling to listen to his own advisers, even as they explain to him that he has lost the election, and his multiple and varied claims to the contrary are not grounded in fact. At one point, Donald Trump did not seem to care whether there was any evidence to support his claims of election fraud, and questioned why he should not push for even more extreme steps, such as replacing the acting Attorney General to challenge his loss. The president said something to the effect of, "What do I have to lose? If I do this, what do I have to lose?" Richard Donahue, a former top Justice Department official, told the committee in an interview. And I said, "Mr. President, you have a great deal to lose. Is this really how you want your administration to end? You're going to hurt the country." Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, also tried to get Donald Trump to stop pursuing baseless claims of election fraud. He pushed back against a plan from a rogue Justice Department lawyer, Jeffrey Clark, who wanted to distribute official letters to multiple state legislatures, falsely alerting them that the election may have been stolen and urging them to reconsider certified election results. That letter that this guy wants to send, that letter is a murder-suicide pact, Mr. Cipollone told Donald Trump, according to Mr. Donahue. It's going to damage everyone who touches it, and we should have nothing to do with that letter. I don't ever want to see that letter again. The account is part of a court filing in a civil case in California, in which the committee's lawyers, for the first time, laid out their theory of a potential criminal case against the former president. They said they had evidence demonstrating that Donald Trump, the lawyer John Eastman, and other allies could be charged with obstructing an official proceeding of Congress, conspiracy to defraud the American people, and common law fraud. The committee's filing shows how some of Donald Trump's aides and advisers repeatedly and passionately tried to get him to back down from his various false claims and plans to try to stay in power. It started almost immediately after the polls closed in November of 2020, when members of Donald Trump's campaign data team began trying to break through to the president to impress upon him that he had been defeated. During a conversation in the Oval Office, Donald Trump's lead campaign data guru delivered to the president in pretty blunt terms that he was going to lose, Jason Miller, another top campaign aide, told the House panel. The president said he disagreed with the data expert's analysis, Mr. Miller said, because he thought he could win in courts of law. Jason Miller also told the committee that he agreed with Attorney General William Barr's analysis that there had not been widespread fraud in the election, and said that to the president on multiple occasions, the panel wrote in its court filing. In the chaotic post-election period, Donald Trump's legal team set up a hotline for fraud allegations and was flooded with unverified accounts from people across the country who claimed they had evidence of fraud. A Postal Service truck driver from Pennsylvania asserted, without evidence, that his 18-wheeler had been filled with phony ballots. Republican voters in Arizona complained that some of their ballots had not been counted because they used Sharpie pens, that could not be read by voting machines. Mr. Trump appeared to be aware of many of these reports and would speak about them often with aides and officials, raising various theories about voting fraud even as they debunked them one by one. When you gave him a very direct answer on one of them, he wouldn't fight us on it, Mr. Donahue, the Justice Department official, told the House committee, but he would move on to another allegation. Mr. Donahue recalled, for instance, how he told Donald Trump that Justice Department investigators had looked into and ultimately discounted a claim that election officials in Atlanta, Georgia, had wheeled a suitcase full of phony ballots into their counting room on election day. Instead of accepting Mr. Donahue's account, Donald Trump abruptly switched subjects and asked about double voting and dead people voting, then moved on to a completely different claim about how, he said, Indians are getting paid to vote on Native American reservations. After Mr. Donahue sought to knock down those complaints as well, he told the committee, Donald Trump changed topics again and wondered aloud why his numerous legal challenges to the election had not worked. Jeffrey Rosen, another top Justice Department lawyer who became the acting Attorney General after William Barr left the agency, fielded this question, according to Mr. Donahue's account, telling the president that he was free to bring lawsuits but that the department could not be involved. Even though none of Donald Trump's persistent claims about election fraud turned out to be true, prosecutors will most likely have to grapple with the question of this, of his state of mind at the time, specifically the issue of whether he believed the claims were true, said Alan Rosenstein, a former Justice Department official who teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School. Alan Rosenstein said, to the extent that the prosecutors had to show intent, Trump's delusion makes that harder. A finder of fact could conclude that Donald Trump is so uniquely narcissistic and self-absorbed that he actually thought the election had been stolen. Throughout December, Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donahue repeatedly informed Donald Trump that both his specific and general claims of election fraud were false. At a White House meeting on 15th of December 2020, Donald Trump was told that people are telling you things that are not right, the committee said. Mr. Donahue personally informed Donald Trump during a 27th of December phone call in very clear terms that the Justice Department had done dozens of investigations, hundreds of interviews, had looked at Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada, and concluded that the major allegations are not supported by evidence. The House panel also found evidence that some of the allies most deeply involved in Donald Trump's efforts to overturn his loss were aware that their endeavor lacked legal merit. Mr. Eastman, the conservative lawyer who advised Donald Trump that Vice President Mike Pence could throw out election votes from states he had lost, conceded during a conversation with Mr. Pence's top lawyer, Greg Jacob, that his arguments carried no legal weight and would fail before the Supreme Court. A rejection of electors by the vice president would be a relatively minor violation of federal law, Mr. Eastman acknowledged, agreeing with Mr. Jacob's assessment that even the most conservative justices would reject it. If this case got to the Supreme Court, we'd lose 9-0, wouldn't we? Mr. Jacob recalled telling Mr. Eastman, according to his interview with the House committee. And he started out at 7-2, and I said, who are the two? And he said, well, I think maybe Clarence Thomas. And I said, really? Clarence Thomas? And so we went through a few Thomas opinions, and finally he acknowledged, yeah, all right, it would be 9-0. The committee recently received documents from the National Archives that showed some of Donald Trump's activities on 6th of January 2021. Among them were a morning meeting that included his eldest son's fiancée, Kimberly Guilfoyle, who has turned over 110 pages of documents to the House Committee and was issued a subpoena on Thursday. A call with former Senator Kelly Loeffler, Republican of Georgia, and a call with Mike Pence as he tried to persuade the Vice President to go along with his plans. More than 150 police officers would be injured during the mob violence that would cost several people their lives. At 4:45 p.m., with the Capitol still under attack, on 6th of January 2021, Mr. Eastman wrote to Mr. Jacob, "When this is over, we should have a good bottle of wine and a nice dinner someplace."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Clashes at Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan were one of the most violent. Israeli occupation forces attacked Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque, wounding more than 150 Palestinians, while it was filled with Ramadan worshippers. Isn't Al-Aqsa a place of worship for Muslims? Why, then, do they become a victim of Israeli violence? Meanwhile, condemnations have poured in from Iran to Saudi Arabia, with the EU and the U.S. to have only expressed grave concern.
Tensions are high in the occupied territories amid a recent increase in crackdown on Palestinians. Regime forces attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque on Friday. Scores of Palestinians were wounded in the clashes. Around 400 people were also arrested. Muslim nations as well as resistance groups have condemned Tel Aviv. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation called on the international community to force Israel to end its aggression. Iran said Friday's events in Muslims' third holiest site show that the Palestinian resistance is alive and thriving, and Israel is in a state of desperation. Analysts believe that Tel Aviv is intentionally increasing tensions to take control of Al-Aqsa Mosque.
I think that the Israelis are escalating the whole situation in the West Bank in order, at least in Jerusalem, in order to control the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that was the aim for the settlers groups who announced many times that they wanted, to get into Al-Aqsa Mosque and practice some of their own religion kind of practices. If they did such an act, definitely that would lead to a war.
The clashes came after 3 weeks of deadly tensions in the occupied territories. Tel Aviv has deployed more forces to the West Bank and conducted raids and house searches there almost every day. This has resulted in the deaths and injuries of dozens of Palestinians. Israel's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, has given Israeli forces a free hand in their operations. Many believe that the latest escalation could turn into an uprising or a new intifada in Palestine.
Palestinian experts are warning that they could return back, let's say, to more clashes, more escalation. These killings by the Israeli forces and this escalation could any time turn into an uprising or an intifada. No one can tell, especially that the Israelis are saying they will not end their operation. It will continue.
Palestinians have also increased their operations in response to the crackdown. Since March 22nd, they have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv, leaving 14 Israelis dead. The increase in anti-Israel operations in the occupied territories show that Palestinians have reached a conclusion that they should decide their own fate, especially after several Arab countries normalized ties with Israel. Palestinians believe that resistance against occupation is the only way they have to achieve their goals.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Human rights advocate and Palestinian activist Amal Wahdan joins us from Ramallah. We also have writer, journalist, and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Amal Wahdan, and let's talk about what has occurred in terms of the violence part. And the reason why I'd like to start off with this is because we need to enlighten viewers and people watching as to how the Israeli forces used extreme, means here. Looking at the entire mosque that were raided by the Israeli occupation forces, firing live bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades, preventing access to paramedics, and attacking the mosque guards, health workers, and media personnel, resulting in 150 Palestinians to have been wounded. What do you think about the tactics and the level of violence that was used by the Israeli forces?
Yeah, these tactics that they have used has surprised the prayers who were in Al-Aqsa Mosque since the raid came just after dawn. So People were not expecting a raid that early, but this is actually a part of their aggression measures, you know, increasing and escalating their measures against Palestinians. Not only this, the excessive use of arms, excessive use of tear gas and sound gas. Players did not expect this, so they took them in a sudden action. And it caused a lot of chaos, a lot of damage to the mosque. Inside the mosque, can you imagine, you know, anybody who's listening to us now, if a police force stormed into a church or a synagogue or a mosque in somewhere else in the Western world, this will become a real scandal, you know. They will call the ICC to investigate and take actions against the country, against the police forces. But in Palestine, the Israeli arms, the Israeli army, the Israeli special forces can do anything in any place. No boundaries for them to act like barbaric and like Nazis, actually. This is a fascist country. It was categorized as an apartheid state. And that last time, you know, a few days ago, Bennett has given the settlers and individuals the right to own guns and use these guns. We know that settlers in organized groups, they have their guns. They are like paratroopers to the Israeli army. But now they are giving a free hand to everybody to own arms. This is a call for war. And what happened in Al-Aqsa Mosque, actually, as your report showed, that they arrested people, hundreds of people. The number that we know is 400 people. But the injured were, the first count of injured were 250. Part of them were treated in Al-Aqsa Mosque, okay, paramedics tent, and some of them were transferred to Al-Maqasid Hospital. 10 people yesterday were
critical condition.
Yes, in very critical condition, and others were hit in the eyes, for example.
Sure, and that's what I want to talk about even more. I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, Hafsakar Mustafa, but videos showing worshippers lying on the ground, their hands tied behind their backs, children to be among the ones who are arrested, worshippers beaten by Israeli police while evacuating. You know, the aggression here is so severe that it's skimmed over and when it's covered by the media. Meanwhile, Israel has attempted to spin the police raid, as they call it in Alaska, as an effort to protect the freedom of worship. So we can see who they're trying to serve and how they're trying to spin the story. Do you agree that they're doing that?
Well, of course not, but I think we have to put this into the current context, which is that the international media and international interest and focus is currently now on Ukraine. And what the Israelis do, and they routinely do this, is that when there's a major world event that is distracting world opinion, they will make the most of it by going on a killing spree of Palestinians. And that's exactly what they've done. They're literally making the most of this current war in Eastern Europe, which is attracting a lot of attention, and using it as an opportunity to carry out ethnic cleansing operations and operations inside places of worship that actually we wouldn't have seen Nazis do. I mean, for the past 70 years, we've heard of the horrors of the Holocaust and Nazi operations against Jews, but actually this puts Nazis to shame. This is far beyond what we've seen for 5 years happening in Germany. This has been going on for 70 years. This is an attack. These are war crimes. These are immoral crimes that should be condemned vehemently by the international community, and they're not, because Israel currently enjoys total impunity and is making the most of the situation, by which is distracting, public opinion is distracted by the war in Ukraine, and they're making the most of it, knowing that essentially only Middle Eastern media will actually take interest in what's happening, whilst obviously Western media is focused elsewhere.
Amal Wahdan, perhaps you can tell us why we are having this problem carry on for all these decades, which is what's been called the flashpoint of Al-Aqsa Mosque, sacred to Muslims. We know how Jews feel about that. Why has this been a flashpoint? What can be done to remove that status?
This apartheid state was created by the superpower, by the British first, and then sponsored and nourished by the USA and the NATO countries. So this apartheid country is above any law, above international law, above human rights law. In the UN Security Council, General Assembly, they can escape any impunity, any action to stop them. We cannot even take them to ICC. The most that we can do is bring an investigation to their crimes. So this is one part of why this state is carrying what it's doing right now. And storming in and raiding Al-Aqsa Mosque the way they did is an escalation to a situation that was going on before. You know, groups of settlers from different settlers, radical organizations, have raided Al-Aqsa Mosque, not storming in, you know, walking in or making silence prayer. They took an order from the court that they can do silent prayer in Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is inciting Muslims, and this is violating the Muslim rights of worshipping in their sacred shrines in Al-Aqsa Mosque. So barging into Al-Aqsa yesterday and raiding Al-Aqsa while you know, worshippers were ready to go for the dawn prayer is something that cannot be tolerated. And even if there wasn't any war somewhere else like Ukraine, the international community would not even take a real measure. They will condemn, they will bring, you know, they will send some convoy delegations and delegations here, but they will not take action against this apartheid regime. Nothing is going to stop them. They are going to repeat what they did in Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron. So what happened is a big, you know, it's a flashing alarm towards the whole world. But for us Palestinians, we're continuing what we are doing right now. We're resisting. We're resisting these racist and discriminated system here. We're going to continue resisting.
Sure. Hafsa Khan Mustafa, one of the most interesting things, maybe not too much of a surprise, but yet enough of a surprise, are the demographics of some of the Palestinians that have actually protested recently. And I'm talking about in specifically what happened in Tel Aviv and also then other Palestinians who are not affiliated with the resistance groups like Hamas or the ones out of the Gaza Strip or even to the PA or any groups or any ideology. And they're coming out and they're protesting. What does that show when you're seeing Palestinians that have no affiliation of any kind coming out and actually carrying out what's been called resistance operations? Which, well, the one in Tel Aviv is the one that was the most severe in terms of the results that came out of that.
Well, first of all, it does show that the Palestinian people are united in condemning the Israeli actions. But of course, it also shows that this is a problem that impacts all of Palestinian society, and it doesn't have to be exclusive to one political party. Of course, in the eyes of the Israelis and how they want to spin it, they would like to present that these actions made by Palestinians are exclusively reserved to groups that are affiliated to political parties. But actually, the upset is generalized and is across the board across Palestinian society, from all ages and from all social groups, and exactly from whether they are politicized or not. So I think this is a reflection of the upset that you have amongst Palestinians of all scopes. And I think it's mirrors the scale of the atrocity that's being committed. Obviously, this is not targeting militias or certain armed groups. This is targeting civilians who are going about their daily lives and inside places of worship, which makes it not only immoral, but actually and legally a war crime.
You talked about Amal Wahdan, about the settlers. Tell us, first of all, it's very alarming that you said that they are now allowed to bear arms. I don't have information on that, but that makes the situation rather very dangerous. Because if you can explain to us why it is that they are allowed to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque sporadically at intervals, not really well thought out or well planned from what it seems, and they are given escort by the Israeli security forces. Can you please explain to us what that story is all about?
First of all, the Islamic organization in Al-Aqsa Mosque has denounced the continuous storming into Al-Aqsa Mosque. Settlers going almost each day, day in, day out. So the settlers took this to the court, and the court allowed them to do silence praying in Al-Aqsa, which means this is the first step for them, having silence prayer, then having real prayer inside Al-Aqsa, then sacrificing, performing sacrifices in Al-Aqsa Mosque as they wanted to do yesterday. Later on, splitting, time and space, just like in Al-Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron. So what they are doing is a gradual, step by step to occupy Al-Aqsa and then do what's in their, what's in their mind, ruining Al-Aqsa. What happened yesterday is has happened in 1969 when they burned Al-Aqsa, and it was really horrifying for all Muslims. Unfortunately, the Arab world has not reacted in the same, in the same level of this action. And they only condemned these massive storming in and raiding into Al-Aqsa. So what is needed to be done here is real action. And the people of Palestine had to decide that they are going to take the power into their own hands and they're going to defend themselves. What we have to remind the whole world that we are in a defensive position, even when people like young people like Diyan.